the point of the story of Jacob's deception was God had made promises, but Jacob tries to achieve those promises on his own strength, with his own wiles. God makes very clear it's not going to be through your own efforts that the promises are going to be achieved.
Right.
And that's kind of the lesson of Jacob's life, despite his sin, trying to think he has to achieve God's promises by himself. God shows grace to him and slowly teaches Jacob to wait and trust him.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hey there, and welcome to the White Horse Inn. I'm Shane Rosenthal, and on this episode, as we're continuing our series on the Gospel in Genesis, we'll be talking about that mysterious scene in Genesis 32 in which Jacob wrestles with God. As I've read and interacted with numerous commentaries about this famous passage, I discovered a common theme. The way the story is often told, this was a time in which Jacob refused to let go of God until he received the blessing he desired. And the practical lesson, of course, is that all of us should wrestle with God, for example, in prayer, and that we too should refuse to let him go until we receive our blessing. But is this really the point of Genesis 32, as Jacob wrestles with God and receives a new name and identity? Or is this strange encounter another one of those clear examples of the gospel in the book of Genesis? That's what we'll be talking about on this edition of the program. And joining me to discuss this important passage are two authors who've been on the program recently. Matt Foreman is a lecturer in practical theology at Reformed Baptist Seminary and pastor of Faith Reformed Baptist Church in Media, Pennsylvania. And Doug Van Dorn is the pastor of Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado and the author of many books, including Christ in the Old Testament. Together, Matt and Doug co-wrote a book that I highly recommend, titled The Angel of the Lord, A Biblical, Historical, and Theological Study. Matt and Doug, thanks so much for joining me again for another episode of the White Horse Inn.
It was great to get your call, Shane, and we're excited to do the program.
Yeah, we really enjoyed the last conversation, so I'm excited about this one as well.
So before we start talking about Genesis 32, it might be helpful for our listeners if we give a brief overview of some of the things that have taken place over the past few chapters. If you recall, Jacob had originally fled the Promised Land because his brother had threatened to kill him for deceiving his father and swindling his birthright. In fact, it was by his deceptive actions that Jacob ended up securing for himself and all of his posterity the fruitful land that God promised to Abraham, whereas Esau and his descendants were now destined to live in the dry and arid region of Edom. But is this how the people of Israel would end up inheriting the Abrahamic blessing, through Jacob's deceitful tactics? What do you guys think is the overall point that readers are meant to consider in this part of the Genesis narrative?
You know, going backing up all the way to Abraham and the beginning of his story is that, this is really about God picking a family that are anything but perfect.
Yeah.
And about him changing who they are as people, including changing their names. That's something we're going to see for sure in Genesis 32.
Yeah, I would say that we all would recognize that Jacob's deceitfulness was sin. He starts off as a pretty miserable human being. And through the course of his life, God works on him. You know, I think part of the message of Jacob's life is God working on an unrighteous, unworthy man and slowly sanctifying him. So that the point of the story of Jacob's deception was God had made promises, but Jacob tries to achieve those promises on his own strength, with his own wiles. And yet the message in Genesis, you go back to the story of Sarah and Hagar and Abraham trying to achieve the promised son through his own efforts. God makes very clear it's not going to be through your own efforts that the promises are going to be achieved.
Right.
And that's kind of the lesson of Jacob's life, despite his sin, trying to think he has to achieve God's promises by himself. God shows grace to him despite that and slowly teaches Jacob to wait and trust him.
Yeah, one of the passages that I keep coming back to, I've mentioned it throughout the series, is Deuteronomy 9. You know, God says to the people of Israel, "Do not say in your heart, 'It's because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me in to possess the land.' It is not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart for you are a stubborn people. You know, essentially the same thing is true even here at the beginning of the story. Jacob is not entering the land because he's got clean hands and a pure heart, is he?
I mean, Abraham didn't enter the land for that reason. It's funny, like chapter 12 of Genesis, God says, hey, Abraham, I'm going to give you this great land and this great covenant. And then the very next thing he does is he lies to the Pharaoh about Sarah.
Right.
Like that's the very first thing he does. And throughout Abraham's life, you've got the whole Hagar thing that led to the birth of Ishmael. And you've got Abraham letting Lot get the pick of the land that wasn't even promised to him. I mean, over and over, you see these patriarchs and the characters, whether it's the husband or the wife, you know, doing things that are exactly what you bring up there in Deuteronomy 9. It's not their righteousness.
In your book on the angel of the Lord, you guys have a chapter on this famous wrestling scene from Genesis 32. And you point out that in the preceding chapter, Jacob tells Rachel that the angel of God appeared to him in a dream, saying, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made a vow to me. Arise and go to this land and return to the land of your kindred. What do you guys think is significant about what he says there in Genesis 31?
Well, one of the things you have to do throughout the book of Genesis is recognize the intertextuality of all these stories, that all of these stories are meant to be read and linked together. So you go back to chapter 28, when Jacob first leaves his home, he comes to this place, he lays down to sleep, and he has this dream of the famous stairway to heaven where God appears to him there. And for the first time in Jacob's life, when he's empty-handed, God meets with him. God claims him. God says, I'm going to make my covenant with you. And then, you know, several chapters later, he's gone through this whole situation with his uncle Laban, and he's labored for years. He's now has his two wives. And in chapter 31, he's now told, go back to the promised land. And 31 is really interesting in the language because, you know, Jacob says to his wife, the angel of God appeared to me in a dream. And the angel told me to go back to the land of my fathers. And the angel said to him, I am the God of Bethel, meaning I am the God who appeared to you several chapters before. And so even though in 28, the term angel of God is not mentioned, the intertextuality makes clear that it was this divine angel appearing to Jacob the whole time.
Yeah. So the point you guys make in your book is that the angel of the Lord or the messenger of Yahweh is the second person of the Trinity, but in a kind of pre-incarnate form, or in this case, in a dream.
Yeah. It's a vision of a spiritual place, this link between heaven and earth. And he is seeing that person right there in front of him.
You guys also point out that in Genesis 35, God appeared again to Jacob and he said, arise, go up to Bethel, make an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau. What do you think is unique about the language we find there?
Well, this is the kind of language that you see over and over again when the angel appears or when God is working in a personal way. You see this language of this person being sent by God, who is God, who speaks as God, and it also speaks about God. And sometimes the actual identification of the speaker gets blurred, like in a case like this in Genesis 35. Where is that? He says, arise, go to Bethel, make an altar to the God who appeared to you. So it's this God appearing or God speaking to him, and yet speaking to him about the God who appeared.
Yeah, that's really mysterious.
One of the things that's interesting, in one of the versions of the Septuagint, there's really interesting language there that says, arise, go to Bethel, make an altar there to the God who appeared in the place of God. The one who came as the mediatorial revelation of God.
You quote in your book at one point a line from Calvin who said, you know, when you find the reference to this angel of Yahweh, we're to think of Christ because he is the one who has been the supreme and perpetual mediator. Do you think one of the reasons we don't often connect this to Christ is because when we hear the word angel, we think of an angelic being, but in Hebrew, malach connects us to the idea of a messenger, an ambassador, and angels have that function, which is why we can also mean angel. But because in English, we think of the being, not the function, we tend to think of the angel of the Lord as an angelic being of some kind. We don't connect it easily to Christ. But if we take what Calvin is saying, that this connects us to the idea of a mediator. He is the ultimate messenger who mediates God's presence.
I mean, the word angels, it's doing both things at the same time, I think, where it's what kind of a creature is this, but it's also got the function of it. And, you know, I think you're bringing up a good point with Calvin. He's focusing on the messenger. I think that point that you brought up about people not easily seeing the angel of the Lord as the second person, probably it does have to do with the fact that they focus on the idea of what an angel is. And the first thing that pops in your head is that an angel is a created being.
Right.
You know, this is an eternal being. But whenever these kinds of things come up, I like to tell people, well, humans are created beings too, but Jesus Christ incarnated as one of us. So
great point.
The word is not created, but that flesh that he took on in Mary's womb was, and somehow the two meet together in the mediator, the intercessor, which adds that extra layer that I think Calvin is looking at.
Yeah.
I also think it's sometimes just the simple fact that we don't read as carefully as we should.
Hmm.
And so our eyes just kind of gloss over it. When in chapter 31, verse 3, where it says, "The Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your father." So it's Yahweh. And then several verses later in verse 11, Jacob says, "The angel of God said to me in a dream, Jacob." And we just kind of gloss over it when we're reading it. Oh, that's God, you know, and we don't connect the fact that Jacob's saying that Yahweh, who spoke to him earlier,
yeah,
was now the angel of Yahweh. And we don't pick up those fine details, which are all over the place. And yet you have Old Testament scholars who are telling us we need to pay attention to these things. Gerhardus Voss, in one point, in speaking about the Genesis narratives, talks about these kind of distinctions where Yahweh will speak and then make a distinction between himself and Yahweh. And is that just kind of rhetorical Hebraism, or is there something in the language there that is deliberately meant to be provocative? And when you realize the Jews themselves picked up this kind of language,
right,
and recognized that there was a mediated revelation going on. But you put these things together, we think, you know, from the Old Testament, we as Christians have to say this can be no other than Jesus, the person of the Son in the Old Testament.
You bring up an interesting point there, Matt, that I can't tell you how many times I have had this experience. I'm teaching this kind of stuff, and four or five people at the same time say, "When did you put this into my Bible? I've never had this in there before." You know, they've read the Bible 20 times, that passage, and they're like, "I've never seen this." It's we don't read carefully enough. I think that's definitely part of it.
Yeah, I have that experience teaching geography. I think there's all kinds of fascinating geographical details in the Gospel of John that helps us to root this in real history in a real place. And many people have never noticed those details because they're looking for the bright, shiny object in the text, you know, this really spiritually significant thing. And as you say, some of these things, if you don't understand either the geography or the mysterious language of this angel, you just don't really focus on it. And that's why you've never noticed it.
Yeah.
Now, I'd like to ask you guys a question about one of these nitty gritty details that appears in Genesis 28. In verse 13, according to the ESV, Yahweh stands above the great stairway and speaks to Jacob. But apparently there are a couple of other options in the original Hebrew. When I interviewed Richard Bauckham last year, he preferred the NRSV reading, which says that the Lord stood next to him, referring to Jacob. And then I also came across the Septuagint way of translating this in verse 13. According to that reading, it says the Lord stood upon it, referring to the stairway itself. As I've studied the passage, I think that option ends up fitting the best because of what Jesus tells Nathanael in John 1:51. He says, you know, "You will see angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." In other words, in that passage there, Jesus seems to be identifying with that stairway itself. And that, to me, connects to a lot of other passages in John, you know, when he says, "I am the gate, I am the way." What do you guys think about applying Jesus' own words to the Genesis 28 narrative and how that helps us to understand it?
There's no question that Jesus is referencing this story in John 1:51. So I think that we are obligated to have that story inform what we're looking at in Genesis 28.
But I guess what I used to think is the Lord standing above the ladder so that you kind of had father and son in the narrative. But if you look at Genesis 31, it says the person who revealed himself to Jacob was actually the angel of the Lord. And so it makes more sense to me now to see, since it's an option in Hebrew, that the Lord is standing on the ladder connecting it with what Jesus actually says, that he is the ladder.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So instead of seeing two persons or whatever, it's that the second person is the one who's kind of all consuming in the vision.
Yes.
And I don't know that it really matters a whole lot whether he's on, you know, in the middle of the ladder, the ziggurat, or if he's on top of it, or if he's next to Jacob, because all those could have different symbolic meanings for what Jesus does. He's standing next to Jacob, so he's coming to the man, or he's in the middle of the ladder. He is the ladder, like I think probably what John is saying, or if he's on top of it, he's the Lord of it, and he's the goal of the whole thing. So the point is that you're bringing out is that it is the Son who Jacob sees.
Right.
I think that idea of ascending and descending is important. Later on in John 3, he says, no one has ascended into heaven except him who descended from heaven,
right,
the Son of Man. And you actually see that kind of language appearing several times in John. You see it in Ephesians chapter 4, where Ephesians talks about the one who ascended is the one who descended. And I think that language is certainly pointing back to the Son of Man in the Old Testament, the divine angel in the Old Testament as the one who descended. But I definitely think you're right that he is the Lord of the staircase.
Yeah.
He's the one identified with the staircase. He's the one sending out the angels to do his bidding, to be his servants, to minister his will. And he is the one himself is coming down. So you get this idea of there's this condescension of God from the beginning to come down to Jacob, to reveal himself to him. And he's the one who's always been descending and ascending. So you get to the New Testament. Well, who's the one who's always been descending and ascending? It's always been this divine Son who in the New Testament is now descending in a brand new way because he's actually taking on flesh.
Yeah.
And that transforms everything. Here he's really with us, not just in a temporary way, but in an eternal way.
I mentioned that passage that you quoted from Jesus' conversation to Nicodemus before in this series. You know, no one has ascended to heaven except for he who descends from heaven. And it's a really helpful passage which shows, you know, the contrast between Genesis 11, Tower of Babel, us climbing up to heaven, and Genesis 28, where the ladder descends from heaven. But other texts come to mind too. You know, who will ascend the hill of the Lord? Psalm 24, you know, he who has clean hands and a pure heart, which again, we've seen is not Jacob or Abraham or any of the patriarchs.
Yeah, when you think about that verse in 3:13, John 3:13, no one has ascended, no one has gone up to heaven except him who descended. Okay, well, we know the descended one is, you know, the one who came down, the Son of Man, and yet he's saying he has previously ascended to heaven.
Yeah.
Well, when did that happen? You know, that happened in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
You know, I think that becomes clear when you think about it.
Yeah, the Lord of the staircase can ascend and descend whenever he wills.
Right.
You know, I find it really interesting that Jacob encounters a host of angels ascending and descending this great staircase just before he departs from the promised land in Genesis 28. And as he returns to the place of God's dwelling some 20 years later, as recorded in Genesis 32, once again, he encounters an encampment of angels. I don't know about you guys, but I sort of think of this as I link it to the language we find throughout the Old Testament to the effect that the promised land is a kind of new Eden. And so as Jacob sees an encampment of angels on his return, essentially the border of the promised land is being clearly defined as God's country. But if that's right, and I'd love to get your opinion on it, then the question in my mind arises as to why this sinner is in effect permitted to re-enter Eden, you know, past the cherubim with the flashing sword. What do you guys think?
I think that you're onto something for sure. Like you go back to Genesis 13, and this is when Abraham offers Lot the land, which I take that as that wasn't a good thing. He wasn't supposed to do this. It was given to him, not to Lot. But it says Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord. And so this whole promised land, this land that God gave to Abraham, and that's the key to your question. It's God gave this to him. He's not taking it by force. This language of what it looks like, reminding us of the Garden of Eden. The reason why Jacob's allowed to do it, it's the same reason why Abraham was allowed to do it, because God covenanted with him and he just simply gave him a grant and gave him a gift. I'm going to give you this land because it's my land to give, and I'm going to do something with you that nobody could ever imagine in their wildest dreams.
Well, and I think you're pointing out that the text is drawing your attention to Jacob coming back to the land. You know, that language in chapter 32, verse 1, the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's camp. So he called the name of the place Mahanaim. And it doesn't say anything else.
Right.
It's just, that's it. It's like, what in the world is that there for? Why, yeah. Why do we need to know that? And you, here's Jacob. He's entered back into the land of his fathers. And yet this is where, you know, where God is. This is where God's will is being done. And I think you see parallels like that later. The most obvious one being in Joshua, when the nation of Israel crosses the Jordan into the promised land.
Yeah.
And they're about to go to Jericho. And that's where Joshua meets the commander of the army of the Lord. So they're in the land and he meets a supernatural angel who is God himself. And it's kind of this same imagery, you know, as God's people enter into God's place, God lets them know you're in my territory now.
Same with the temple too. I mean, you have the images of the cherubim on the curtains, separating, you know, the holy place. And then there's the entrance into the most holy place. But all that was inside that amazing temple was, you know, Edenic imagery.
And so the question is going to become, this is going to lead into, I think, where we're going with this. As Jacob is entering into the promised land again, entering the land of his fathers, the land promised to him, is he going to trust God?
Well, so like Cain, Jacob deserves to be exiled from the land. I mean, Cain murdered his brother and Jacob cheated and deceived his brother. Well, he cheated his brother, deceived his father. And yet out of God's sheer grace and mercy, he's invited back, not because of works, as Paul says in Romans 9:11, but because of him who calls. And this is something that you guys point out in your book. I like what you guys said in one of your chapters. You said that basically the story of Jacob presents us with the gospel in the Old Testament, God coming to an unworthy people, claiming them as his own, intervening in their lives, purposing to be their God, to give them a home and a future and a purpose to one day bless the whole earth. I mean, that's basically the story in a nutshell.
It's funny, you just cited Romans 9, not because of works, but because of him who calls. And right in that very same place, God says, before the twins were born or had done anything good or bad in order that God's purpose and election might stand. So that just, I mean, that's right into what we've been talking about. This is not about anything other than God's purpose and grace to Jacob, who, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I read the story of Jacob and Esau, every time I read it, I go, Jacob's a scoundrel, but it's not according to outward works. It's according to what God wants to do in his purposes.
Yeah. Now in verse 3 and following of Genesis 32, Jacob sends messengers to his brother Esau saying, thus you shall say to my lord Esau, I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male servants, and female servants. I have sent to tell my lord in order that I might find favor in his sight. You know, as I consider the words that Jacob uses here, calling his brother his lord, attempting to find favor in his sight through various offerings, it seems like this is language that is usually applied to God. I mean, if you look at a text like Genesis 18:3, you have all these words. You know, Abraham says to basically the angel of the Lord who appears to him there in that scene, O Lord Adonai, if I have found favor in your sight, and then he brings him various offerings. So it seems like, you know, again, looking at the intertextuality, seeing how certain other passages relate to this passage, it seems like Jacob is treating his brother in a way that's similar to the way other saints have treated God.
Yeah, I think this passage is deliberately ambiguous. What you do see is that Jacob's attitude in returning is different than when he left.
Mm-hmm.
He is coming back with a much greater deal of humility. The way he speaks of his brother is more honoring of his brother.
But it's kind of like a humility mixed with misplaced fear, because he's,
right.
As he's coming back into the land, he is obsessed with his brother and afraid of him, and he's not fully aware of the significance of what it means to return to God's presence. And so he finds out in verses 6 and 7 that Esau is coming with 400 men, and he becomes greatly afraid and distressed. That theme of his fear just keeps coming up again and again. But one thing that seems to be missing is the fear of the Lord. What do you guys think?
Well, I was just thinking there's also a lesson in this for the later nation of Israel.
Hmm.
You know, their wanderings in the wilderness, coming to the promised land, facing enemies who are strong.
Right.
And, you know, here's this story from their past that Moses uses, you know, inspired by God to tell them, are you going to trust God? Are you going to give in to fear? Are you going to trust yourself?
Are you going to be afraid of the powerful, strong, tall men?
Exactly. The hairy red men.
Yeah. In verse 7 of Genesis 32, Jacob is greatly afraid and distressed. So he divides into two camps, thinking, you know, if Esau comes and attacks the camp, the one that is left will escape. And so this is where he prays, as you said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred that I may do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and of the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For only with my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I've become two camps. In his recently published Genesis commentary, national radio talk show host Dennis Prager writes that, quote, Jacob's behavior is often viewed as unscrupulous, but it's quite defensible. And another commentator writes this, yes, Jacob was a deceiver, but deception is not always sinful. In this case, Jacob was a righteous deceiver. Jacob was a good man, a blameless man who righteously deceived those who opposed God's covenant. I don't know about you guys, but I don't think that approach really fits well with what we find here in Jacob's prayer. I mean, he seems to get the fact that he's unworthy of God's steadfast love, doesn't he?
Right. I mean, Jacob's a hero in the prayer only because he admits he's unworthy and he's not to be emulated.
Right.
Like, it's kind of the opposite of what they're saying. Those kinds of interpretations, they're frustrating because they literally miss the most obvious point that's like right in front of your eyes.
Yeah.
From the name of the man himself, deceiver. Like, his name isn't righteous deceiver. His name is deceiver. That's what Jacob is. And the whole narrative of his life plays out that way until his name is changed.
And part of the point of the sanctification of Jacob is that he's not, you know, ending his life, you know, the way he began. God takes him on a journey, and there's a point to the journey because he needs to become a different man. How awful would it be if he comes to the end and he's exactly the way he was at the beginning?
Yeah.
You know, he was a righteous deceiver from the beginning. That's how he got the promises of God. That's not it at all. It's God teaching him, despite all the things that he did wrong to try to get things for himself, that it's God's promises that he has to trust in and not himself.
Yeah, exactly. Jacob's prayer continues in verse 11. He says, please deliver me from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he may come and attack me, the mothers with their children. But you said, I will surely do good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. You know, again, his words let us know what Jacob is preoccupied with as he's re-entering the promised land. He specifically says that he's afraid of being attacked by his brother. So as a result, he sends wave after wave of presents ahead of him, including hundreds of goats, sheep, camels, cows, all in an attempt to appease his brother's anger. Perhaps, he says in verse 20, he shall accept me. Again, when you look closely at the language that's used here, many of these words come up in relationship to the sacrificial system. He's giving offerings that are meant to appease his brother, and the Hebrew word there for appeasement is atonement. And the goal is that he'll be accepted by his brother, which is the same word that God used back in Genesis 4, where he said to Cain, if you do well, will you not be accepted? What do you guys think about some of those parallels?
He's certainly not worshiping Esau, but he's fearing him and not in a rightful way. And so what does he do? He gives a prayer to God, but he gives all the gifts and the sacrifices to his brother, right?
Yeah. Basically, he's trying to buy his brother off. He's trying to propitiate his wrath again. So this is just another example in my mind of misplaced fear. He's coming into the Holy Land, and it's ironic that you have this language later in the Pentateuch. We'll find all this language applied to Yahweh, but it's here directed to Esau. I mean, think about Jesus' own words in Matthew 10:28. I mean, he says, do not fear those who kill the body, rather fear him who can destroy both body and soul in hell.
Right.
I mean, that side of the equation doesn't seem to be on Jacob's mind at all as he re-enters the Holy Land. There's just no fear of God before his eyes, but he is deathly afraid of Esau.
I was just thinking that Jacob's story is so interesting because it's like God takes years to confront Jacob with himself. He takes Jacob on a journey with his uncle Laban, who was the first time Jacob had met somebody who was a bigger cheater, scoundrel than he was. You know, Laban was a deceiver.
Yeah.
And God uses Laban to challenge Jacob with deception. And, you know, it's ironic that the whole story of him tricking Jacob into marrying Leah, and then, you know, Jacob says, why would you do this? And then Jacob says to him,
it is not so done.
It's not done to give the younger before the older. You know, hello, Jacob.
Right.
This is your life story. So he takes Jacob on this journey to expose his inner demons. Then he takes him back to his family to expose his outer demons. Hmm. And, you know, and now he's got to learn. Now this humbled man has to learn to become a man of faith.
So now let's take a look at what happens in verses 22 and following of Genesis 32. Jacob arose and took his wives and his 11 children across to the other side of the Jabbok River, and he was left alone. Again, he was in fear that his brother would come and attack him, the mothers with their children. So he puts his family on the other side out of harm's way, and he's prepared to fight Esau by himself. And then in verse 24, just as he fears, he was attacked in the middle of the night. Quote, a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. So what do you guys think would likely go through his mind the moment he's attacked by this unidentified man in the dark?
So strictly from the narrative itself, and given what we said about the complexity of the story and the way that it begins, he's in the camp of God and he's seen angels. But I don't know that that's first in his mind, but nevertheless, we still have to deal with the first couple of verses in the chapter. And then you've got Esau. He's far off, but he's getting closer. And so all of a sudden this guy comes and Jacob's alone. He's sent his family away over the river. Jacob's all by himself. And this man comes in the dark, starts wrestling with him. Who could this possibly be in Jacob's mind? Could it be an angel? Could it be Esau? Could it be the angel of the Lord himself? We don't think we have enough information to know, but we do have enough information to kind of give guesses that this is a strange thing.
Yeah. So my take is that he's already walked past the encampment of angels who seem to give him a free pass. So he doesn't have any reason really to fear them. But we are specifically told about that which he's preoccupied with in Genesis 32:11, when he prays to God saying, please deliver me from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he may come and attack me. So to me, the entire flow of the narrative is setting us up for a surprise attack by Esau. And so when Jacob is finally attacked there in the dark, I don't think there's any question that Jacob would simply have assumed that his wrestling partner was his brother. That's what I think.
I think the thought certainly had to have crossed his mind, you know, in a very real way. There is this bookend of Jacob's life where at the beginning of his life, they're struggling. Esau and Jacob are struggling together in the womb.
Yeah.
So there's this theme throughout Jacob's life that Jacob has been struggling. He struggles with Esau. He struggles with Laban. You know, his two wives struggle with each other, you know, and Jacob has to put up with them.
Yep.
You know, like he learns God's perspective because his two wives are struggling with each other. And like, this is God's way of teaching Jacob, this is what I've been having to put up with you for so long, if you understand this. But so there's this bookend of Jacob's life of wrestling and struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And here he is struggling with this man again. You know, the verse is interesting. You know, it says, verse 24, Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with him. It's like out of the blue.
Yeah.
He's by himself in the dark. And then suddenly he's attacked. His nightmare is coming true. This man starts wrestling with him out of nowhere. Who is this man? And, you know, Esau was definitely on his mind.
I like what you said about the scene being a kind of nightmare for Jacob. I actually agree with that and think that God has in some way become for Jacob an incarnation of his worst nightmare. Sort of his way of saying, you know, you're coming into my land fearing Esau. You need to fear me. Esau is the least of your problems.
Yes. So this becomes like a microcosm of Jacob's whole life.
Hmm.
And Jacob learning, you know, who has been really in charge of all of my circumstances all along? Who really do I have to fear?
You know, in verse 25, I think readers are given a clue that Jacob's assailant is someone other than Esau. You know, when the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket and Jacob's hip was out of joint. In other words, this man seems to have the ability to dislocate a hip by a mere touch, but we're not told whether Jacob understood that what was happening was supernatural. He may just have thought as he's wrestling in the dark that, you know, this is just what happens when you wrestle. What do you guys think? Was this by itself enough for Jacob to realize that his attacker is the creator of the universe?
I don't think so, which is probably why he asked, well, who in the world are you? Like, if it was so obviously God, I think he would have known that.
Yeah, he seems to be confused all the way up to verse 29, where he finally asks for the man's name.
Yes.
But in verse 26, the man says, "Let me go, for the day has broken." But Jacob says, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, you know, many commentators argue that Jacob is refusing to let God go until he receives his blessing. But I'm still not persuaded that Jacob realizes yet who his attacker was. So here in verse 26, if he is still under the impression that he's been attacked by Esau or maybe one of Esau's men, then perhaps what's really happening here is that Jacob is still trying to secure the blessing of firstborn status by his own striving. In other words, he fears his brother and he's going to wrestle the blessing and take the inheritance from him by force. I'm going to settle this thing once for all. What do you think about that way of potentially reading the narrative? You don't have to agree with me.
I actually tend to think that you're probably right. So I can just be your happy accomplice.
Yeah, I think it's possible. It's I go back to, there's a whole host of ambiguity here. So like, I tend to think when the man touches his hip socket, and it's put out of joint, I tend to think that Jacob at this point, it had begun to dawn on him, this is something supernatural. Now, is it God? Is it another kind of lesser being, angel? I don't know. I do think you're right, though, that the blessing connection certainly then connects us back to Esau. You know, Jacob is wondering, coming back to his homeland, the home of his family, and from the beginning of his life, from his birth, you know, God had declared the older is going to serve the younger is going to get the blessing. Jacob thinks he's got to get it on his own. He's still wondering, how am I going to get this? So whether it's he identifies this with Esau, I'm going to wrestle the blessing from you, or he realizes this is some type of supernatural messenger. Either way, I've got to get it by myself. That's what he's thinking.
And that is not a good thing.
Right.
The grabbing, grasping thing is part of his bad characteristic.
Right.
Yeah.
If God has already made the promise, why do I need to wrestle for it?
Well, folks, be sure to join us again next time as I continue my conversation with Matt Foreman and Doug Van Dorn about this mysterious wrestling scene from Genesis 32. Thanks so much for being with us, and we look forward to being with you again next time at the White Horse Inn. The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.